Please turn, if you would, to the book of Esther, the first two chapters of the book of Esther. Now, we're not going to read every single thing out loud. We're not going to read every single verse. And the book of Esther can be a difficult book in some ways because it inserts a lot of names in the midst of the history. And the names are hard for us as Englishmen to read and to understand and to pronounce. And this king's name, this is Xerxes. That's a whole lot easier to pronounce than Ahasuerus. I think I'll just call him Xerxes. And so the background of the book takes place entirely in Persia during Xerxes' reign from 485 to 465 B.C. And if you want to fit the book chronologically in the Bible, you could probably pretty much insert it right between Ezra chapter 6 and Ezra chapter 7. Chronologically, that's probably where it would fit. These things are kind of an inexact science, but that seems to be the best scholarship. There are basically five main characters in the book, and of course, it's King Xerxes himself. And one of the things that I think is important to note is that King Xerxes is not a hero. He's not the hero of the book, although the book never speaks ill of him or says anything against him. History shows him to not be a very good king and not to be a very great leader. And he certainly had a problem. I think we could even paint him as a villain and be correct to do that. The Bible doesn't do that. The Bible makes no moral judgments on him, positive or negative. It simply tells his story and tells the history of what happened. I think really the best way to look at Xerxes is to see him as a tool in the hand of God, much like a hammer being used in the hand of a craftsman pounding nails and making something. I think if we look at it that way, we're probably going to be best. We're not going to find moral lessons to be drawn from the life of Xerxes that's going to be helpful to us. As far as Queen Vashti goes, we can say much the same of her too, except that she's an interesting person and that she's a minor character that we'll deal with today. But without what she does and what happens, the whole story would not be able to take place. So she becomes a very important character in all of this because it's her refusal to obey her husband that causes the whole chain of events to happen, that causes a vacancy in the queenship that sets the way for Esther. And, of course, Esther is a young Jewish girl, probably a teenager. She's basically there because of the captivity and the captivity that had taken place. Of course, the Babylonians had come in and captured the Jews. But about 60 years into that captivity, the Babylonians were overrun by the Medes and the Persians. And Artaxerxes is a Persian king. When you think of the Medes and Persians, you should think of them together, basically. But by this time, we're talking pretty much about Persia. And so that's the circumstances she finds herself in, certainly not very pleasant circumstances. A young girl born in a foreign land, a Jewish girl, no doubt trained in the ways of the Lord. Her parents died when she was very young. Don't know too much about the circumstances of that. And she's raised by her uncle, and some translations say her cousin. And the reason that happens is because we have very defined roles in our Western culture about who your uncle is and who your cousin is and your grandparent, all these things. And the things aren't always so well defined in the ancient world, and especially as they come translating back. He's older than her, so if he is a cousin, he's an older cousin that's like an uncle, or else he is actually her uncle itself. We'll just call him Uncle Mordecai because that's the best thing to do. I have my brother-in-law has a cousin that's about 20 years older than him, and he calls him Uncle, I forgot his name, but Uncle Jeff or Uncle John or whatever. He's actually his cousin. But because he was basically a child when the other fellow was already an adult, they certainly don't have the cousin relationship that you would expect. And so they're either cousins or uncle, but he's definitely older and wiser. And Mordecai the Jew is a very important part of this. And then Haman, the proud, conniving, political wannabe that gets it in the end, as you know the story. So those are basically the main characters that we'll look at as we study this book. The author of the book is unknown. There's a lot of speculation about it. I'll just tell you a couple of the things that are speculated. Some say that Mordecai himself wrote the book, and it's possible that he did. The Jewish people seem to think that it was actually done by Ezra's men, compiled by Ezra's men and edited that way. That's a possibility, too. It's an inspired book, and it's one that we see the hand of God in throughout. In fact, turn to chapter 4, verse 14. Key verse in the book of Esther is right here. This is Mordecai talking to Esther. He says, "If you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet, who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" So basically, there's two thoughts of God's providence there, and that's the theme of the book, is the providence of God. And the fact that God's going to work his purposes, the Jews are going to be delivered, that is a certainty, Mordecai says. He says, but who knows? It well could be that all this has happened so that you'll be the instrument used by God to deliver the Jews. But if you refuse, God's purposes will still be accomplished according to his purposes and according to his will. So that basically is what we're talking about. Let's go to chapter 1 right here. And the first 9 verses, just for sake of time, I'm not going to read them to you, but I'll just capitulate them. Basically, what you have is there's a huge feast that's going on. The Persians were the leading power in the world. The king was proud of his great power, proud of his great wealth, and he held a feast. It's almost unimaginable. The feast lasts 180 days. And you go, well, that's crazy. How could a feast possibly go on that long? Well, actually, if you really dig into it, it lasts 187 days. Because after a 180-day feast, they decide to have one big, huge feast week. And, you know, you do remember, you're dealing with a different culture than what we're used to. And you're dealing with untold wealth and riches. This guy can do pretty much anything that he wants. He's got a huge courtyard. So it's very possible that really the king himself was the only one there for 180 days. He might have been bringing in people and people going out, and people coming in and people going out. And this feast is just one huge ongoing feast that finally culminates in one huge feast for everybody at the very end. And I would think that would be likely and that would be possible. And history shows us that these Oriental kings often did things just exactly like that. We really don't find anything in the book of Esther that is out of the question for what we find in secular history for the way that kings and societies dealt at that particular time. But a problem ensues. The feast on one day gets out of hand. It's a drunken feast, and things get to be a problem. Let's look at verse number 8. "In accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory. For so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure." Now, what we mean by that, usually what would happen at the Oriental feasts is everybody would watch the king. He was the one that they're going to all watch. So when the king has a glass of wine, everybody else takes a drink of wine, everybody else takes a drink of wine. You know, but they had suspended the rules now. Drink whenever you want. Drink as much as you want. You don't have to follow my lead, you know. So that's what it means about it was not compulsory. In other words, it wasn't like king drinks, now we all drink. They were just drinking. And you can imagine how things probably quickly got out of hand in a situation like that. And then you notice verse 9, "Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the royal palace, which belonged to the king." Keep that in mind, because we're going to mention that in just a moment or two. But you notice she has a separate feast that's not the same as the feast of the men. "And then on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded," and here's the eunuchs that he's talking about, verse 11, "to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown, in order to show her beauty to the people and the officers, for she was beautiful to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, brought by the eunuchs. Therefore, the king was furious, and his anger burned within him." So we've gotten right into the heart of the matter now of what the problem is and what the difficulty is. And there's some things that we can absolutely discern from the scriptures here. other things that we can infer, and then there's a lot of speculation that swirls around. We need to be careful in the realm of speculation. We can be absolutely sure about what is said. What's said? Well, it said that she refused to come. That much we know. It said that she was beautiful. Right? And that's undisputed, as it even says it twice. And so we can infer that the reason the king wanted her to come was because he was drunk, he was proud, he was in a celebratory mood, and he wanted to show off his wife. He wanted to showcase her. He wanted everyone to see, not only is this guy rich and can do anything that he wants, look at the beautiful wife that he has on top of it all. And that much I think we could safely infer. The rest of it gets into the realm of speculation. And whenever you're dealing with Jewish writings, and by the way, the book of Esther has more Jewish commentaries on it than any part of Scripture except for the Pentateuch itself, interestingly enough. And so, because it was written right during that time when the Jews were taken up ten, at least more that we know of, let me put it that way, more that had been discovered, more that we're aware of in extent. So we do know that she was beautiful. We can infer that he wanted to showcase that beauty. All kinds of speculation then arise. Well, why did she refuse and what was the situation? And some Jewish scholars have said, well, he wanted her to wear her crown and come in naked. But the text doesn't say that, you see. So that now you're making a massive leap and a massive jump. It would explain why she didn't want to do it, but it's certainly more than what the text would say. Others have speculated that she didn't want to be treated like an object, which is possible, but that's kind of probably reading a little bit of our Western culture into the idea instead of really the way that she would have been thinking. I think if we go back to what we saw in verse number 9, that she had a feast of her own with women, we get an idea of the culture of the day and probably get a little bit of insight into what was actually going on here. Because the Persian culture, as best we can tell, wasn't all that different. It was different, but it wasn't all that different than the Greek culture that would come later. We know a lot more about the Greek culture that came later. And we do know that what would happen oftentimes in public, men would not be with their wives in public. But society was such that they had no problem being with harlots and concubines in public. So they would do that, you know. And that strikes us as very, very strange. But that's what they did. And that's a lot of the background that follows on through into the New Testament, even to the book of Corinth. We see that kind of practice going on. Well, history tells us this is the case. We infer this well probably was the case with the Persians too, especially since we had two feasts going on simultaneously, the important women having their own feast, the men being segregated, but probably having women. And if they had women, they were probably the harlots and the concubines and those that they didn't really have respect for, but used for their own purposes. If that's the case, then we can infer that when he calls for Vashti, she's not going to lower herself to be put in that position, to be a simple, you know, concubine or a harlot. She's the queen, you know. So she said, I think that's a reasonable explanation. I could tell you that it's the inspired explanation because we're not given one. But it's a reasonable explanation, and it would kind of give you an idea of why she would have acted the way that she did and why she would have refused to come. Well, as we continue on, we got the problem. The king is furious. She refuses to come for whatever reason it happens to be. Verse 13 tells us, the king said to the wise men who understood the times. Now, there's another place in the Bible where it talks about there were wise men that understood the times, and it was in a positive way. This really, I don't think we would want to take in a positive way, because these guys are heathens, and they aren't really thinking biblically at all. In fact, I'll make a point of that as we go through here, that they aren't dealing according to biblical principles or trying to deal biblically with the situation. But these were the wise men. These were the counselors. They understood their culture. They understood their times. And their names are given to you in verse 14. The question is asked in verse 15, what shall we do to Queen Vashti according to law? Because she did not obey the command of King Ahasuerus and brought to her by the eunuchs. Now, do remember one important feature here. the law of the Medes and Persians. Who knows what is really specific and unusual about the law of the Medes and Persians? Can't be changed. That's right. Now, I don't think that's a really great way to run your society, just as a political note here. And now let me just delve into just a moment or two of politics, if I can, you know, just as Americans. And this really was not a good thing for the Medes and Persians. To have laws that, once they're enacted, could never be changed, put them into a box that often created problems. Well, what did they do? Well, they did what people always do. They found ways around the law, you know. We're going to see it in the book of Esther. He creates a law that can't be changed. So what's he do? He just passes another law that can't be changed. That's at odds with the other law, and they conflicted with each other. Okay, and well, that's what men will do. They'll always find their way. I think as Americans, one of the things I think we're going to be glad about, you know, why has God preserved us to this point in our history, providentially? My opinion is part of the reason is that we have a constitution. That's a strong document. It's a very simple document, really, if you look at it. The Constitution of the United States is very short. People are sometimes surprised because you go into a law library and you'd see books that would more than fill that wall right there. But the Constitution itself is actually a very small document, you know. And the Constitution is the one thing that holds us together as a country. But it's not unchangeable. Now, it's difficult to change. And I think that's wise, too, because it's not just going on the whims of public opinion. I mean, truthfully, if it went on the whims of public opinion, it would be getting changed all the time, right? But the United States Constitution is hard to change. It takes acts of Congress, then it takes the states having to approve it. And we haven't seen a constitutional amendment passed in an awful long time, you know, and that's because it's so difficult to do. That's really to our protection and to our safety as a people. That's a good thing. Well, the law of the Medes and Persians really wasn't to their protection. We find kings making laws and then regretting that they did because they realize how foolish the laws were that they made. And that's kind of what's going to happen here in this particular case here. So we ask advice, and the advice is given back here in verse 16. Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women, so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes. And when they report that king, let me pronounce his name correctly this time. I like to call him Ahasuerus because I can say that. But the biblical pronunciation of his name here is Ahasuerus. I can't say that. I don't want to try. So, but anyway, that's what we have going on here. And that's just taking his name from into Hebrew. And he's wronged all the people, they say, for the queen's behavior will become known to all women, so they will despise their husbands in their eyes when they report that King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in before him, but she did not come. This very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they've heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus, there will be excessive contempt and wrath. So the counsel is given. If it please the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it will not be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So there's the advice that's given to an angry king. And now he's going to have to decide, what am I going to do? You know? Now, verse 20, let's read that. When the king's decree, which he makes, is proclaimed throughout his empire, for it's great, all wives will honor their husbands, both great and small. And the reply pleased the king and the princes, and the king did according to the word of Memucan. Now, I want to give an interpretive note here that I think we need to do when we come to Old Testament writings. And I think it's very important that we understand the genre that we're looking at when we're interpreting as fair exegetes and as true exegetes of the Word of God. Because there are some people that would tell us that you cannot draw moral lessons from the Old Testament, And we ourselves have been accused by some at times of being moralizers. And I don't mind being called a moralizer when we're dealing with moral issues as they're explicitly taught. There are many moral lessons that we can learn in the book of Esther. There are many moral lessons that are going to be able to draw from the book of Esther. But we need to make sure that we're drawing a proper moral lesson, because there is a moralizing that's improper. And as I read a couple of commentators, I think one commentator in particular, really, I understood where he's coming from, but I felt like he moralized in a way that didn't need to be, because he took the whole idea here of wives honoring their husbands, both great and small, and went on to quite a long diatribe of how important it is in American society for women to listen to their husbands and submit to them, which obviously is a moral truth. That's a moral truth. Is that a moral truth that you draw from this particular passage? I don't think so. And I would not draw that particular truth from this particular passage. And I'll tell you why, and if you have any questions, you can certainly ask here. But the book of Esther is primarily a history. We need to understand that. The writer of the book of Esther makes really no commentaries, good or bad, on the things that are happening. He simply tells us what's happening. And we should be able, from the rest of Scripture, to be able to deduce the moralization of actually what's happening here. And I think what we have, as we see the head of the house principle, if we want to put it that way, in this thing, is the way that I look at it isn't so much that here's a biblical command that God is teaching us from the book of Esther, but here is a pagan society, a wicked society that's very bad, that still has grains of truth running through it, because that's what can be known of men. I mean, there's that little bit of thing. It's not a spark of divinity at all, but it is a knowledge of right and wrong that culture has to work very hard to eradicate, as we find in Romans chapter 1. Now, culture often is able to do that, but there's a spark of understanding in the conscience of what's right and what's wrong, and we see a truth here. But the trouble is, if we take that as a moral prerogative and a moral thing being taught, all the things that are going to happen next, are we going to say they're moral? I mean, he divorces her. I mean, is this grounds for divorce? But he divorces her. And then the next thing that happens, you know, is that he lines up about 400 women to sleep with him and make him his concubine and try to decide which one he wants to be the next queen. I don't think we're going to see moral lessons there that we want to accept and learn from the text. And she, you know, as far as poor Esther goes, I mean, she's a lady that is in very difficult circumstances. She's forced to marry a heathen man who's anything but a good man and a bad man in many respects. And we wouldn't take that as a moral lesson that we would want our girls to do either. So we need to be very, very careful that just when we find a nugget or something that might make us happy, make us glad, that we really are teaching what the Scripture says and not importing our own opinions into what's happening here. And so we cannot commend King Ahasuerus, King Xerxes, for what he's doing here. We cannot commend the wise men for their wise counsel, because their counsel isn't wise at all. But here's an example of how God takes the foolishness of man and works it around for good. And if there's any lesson we can learn of encouragement in the book of Esther, we ought to be able to learn that particular lesson. Because oftentimes in this world, we'll find world leaders, even our own world leaders, making very foolish and stupid decisions, just to be blunt, and doing hurtful things and wrong things. But we do need to understand that behind it all, there is a sovereign God that's still in control and still working. And we pray for our leaders, and we must pray for them no matter who they are. We must pray for them. I've told the story many, many times. When I was in Arkansas during President Clinton's administration, I was preaching in a small little church there. And right before I got up to preach, the pastor stood up and during his pastoral prayer went on about a 5-minute diatribe against President Clinton, including literally in his prayer, "Lord, destroy your enemies and ours." You know, and no, that wasn't good. I was not extremely pleased to take the pulpit after that had happened, because that's actually in direct violation of 2 Timothy 2:1, which tells us to pray for those that are in authority, that we may lead quiet and peaceful lives. And asking God to kill him was probably not exactly the best way to go about things there. I was waiting for the FBI to bust in the doors and, you know, take us all away, but that didn't happen. But at any rate, we need to be careful, because we can become so cynical and we can get so caught up into the world that we don't see the bigger picture. And the bigger picture that we do learn from the book of Esther is that God's in control even when terrible things happen. And if you think about what happened to Esther, these are terrible things, you know. And we're not told the end of her life. You know, we're told basically how she's used to save the Jews. But as I've read histories of Artaxerxes, I would imagine that the end of her life wasn't a very happy life either, you know, because he continued to be an immoral man. He continued to have a lot of problems as he went on his military campaigns. And you can read about those things in history yourself if you'd like to do so. And it doesn't say anything about how Esther fares in all of this. But I can assure you that God took care of her. God used her during the brief time she was on this earth, and God took care of her during the entire time. And that brief time was 70 or 80 years. God took care of her during that brief time. Well, at any rate, you know, the fact, this is a book to show that God allows men to use their own free wills, but the exercise of their free will in no way hinders or stops God from his purposes, and the free will of man cannot change the purposes of God. If we understand that, then we've understood a great deal. And you say, well, explain how that all works out. I can't explain how it all works out. Nobody can explain how it all works out. So if you try, you know, we will fall down on the sovereignty of God and fall onto that end. Our Arminian friends will talk about God changing his plans and people doing this. We disagree. God doesn't change his plans. He doesn't change his plans. We don't know what his plans are. That's what it is. And we're looking at the short run. God's looking at the long haul. I mean, he's been in this business for more than 6,000 years dealing with men, right? So he's obviously in it for the long haul. And we're here for just a brief period of time, as the Bible says, just a vapor that vanishes away. So we must not think that everything started with us and everything is going to end with us. Which is a whole other story, by the way. Because Christianity loves to think we're the terminal generation, we're the very last one. So it's just something really important about being the last one, you know. And that's really popular in American eschatology today. This is it, you know. It's over, you know. We see everything lining up just the way it's supposed to be, you know. Here comes the Antichrist. And you know, I'm not trying to mock. Well, maybe a little bit I am. Okay. I probably am mocking, because error deserves to be mocked. You know, it just, people have been saying this for years. You know, I ran into it again this week as I was dealing with some people, and they are Christian people, good people. They just thought I was just crazy. I said, "What do you mean? You don't see everything lining up? It says right in the Bible this is all going to happen." You know, okay. I don't see the election of 2008 in the Bible. I'm sorry. Just don't see it there. You know, and I don't see everything lining up the way that they did. So anyway, we go on here. And you notice verse 21, the reply pleased the king and the princes. And the king did according to the word of Memucan. Then he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province in its own script. And every people in their own language, you see, with a huge, huge province. And so there were many people groups and many language groups that were there. And King Darius, who had come before, had set up a mass communication system that was very effective with runners and such like that to bring the decrees everywhere. And so he used that system that was still in place, that every man should be master of his own house and speak in the language of his own people. Obviously, every man should be master of his own house is very clear. Speaking the language of his own people is very unclear. And the scholars, admittedly, are uncertain as to exactly what it means. I'll tell you what I think it means. I think the best explanation is simply this. It was a large group. There were many language groups, many people groups. involved. Just think of the old former Soviet Union, how expansive that was, and all of the language groups that were involved. A lot of times we didn't even know that as Americans. We thought they all spoke Russian. And now we find out they broke off into all these different groups, and they all have their own language groups, and they all spoke different. And, you know, well, the Persian Empire was much the same way. They had many language groups within them and many people groups. And basically, the reply of the king was that a man should be the master of his own house. And I think what he's saying is his wife needs to speak the language of him, because there'd be a lot of intermarriage. And so she needs to learn his language to show honor to him. And you might scratch your head and think, well, that's kind of a dumb rule, you know. But in answer back, making dumb rules was never a problem for Artaxerxes. He had a history of doing that. So it well could be. That's exactly what was being said. And that's about the extent of what we would get from that there. So at any rate, we go to verse 1 and we see, after these things, when the wrath of King Artaxerxes subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. And you get a sense that there's a little bit of regret now. You know, he's sobered up, his anger subsided, kind of sorry for what he's done, but he can't change it. So what are we going to do? Well, get another queen. Yeah, now it's time to... Vashti didn't get put to death. Give him credit for that, because that would have been an easy thing to do, to stop with her head and she's gone. He didn't do that. They put her away and never to be seen by him again. But now they have to come up with plan B. And they're going to find a new queen. The king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather all the beautiful young virgins to Shushan, the citadel, into the women's quarters, under the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then let young women who please the king be queen instead of Vashti. This thing pleased the king. And so he did. He was not upset at the suggestion. Let's just put it that way. Okay. So he said, that's a good idea. That's exactly what we'll do. But again, you have to see the hand of God behind it all. So Vashti was a beautiful, beautiful woman. They're going to replace her with somebody, if possible, even more beautiful than she is. And of course, that's where Esther comes in. The Bible does not tell us how Esther came to the attention. It's possible that Mordecai realized what happened and put her in the position where she could be seen. It's possible that she was seen against her will just by those that were going out into all the provinces, and her obvious stunning beauty was such that she stood out, and so they got her. I mean, the Bible didn't tell us, so we don't know how it all came about, but we do know that it did come about. And so we come down to verse number 9, and we find now the young woman pleased him, talking about Esther, pleasing this fellow that was the head of the court of the women. And so he readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance. The 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. Whether it was her stunning beauty, no doubt that's part of it. Her good character, no doubt that's part of it. The real reason all this happened is obviously the providence of God, that he gave her favor over the others in the sight of this man who's very powerful and going to have a lot to say about what happens. But Uncle Mordecai is still around. Look at verse 7. Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is her Jewish name, and still is a very popular Jewish name to this day. Mordecai brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So that's what we talked about earlier. Now, Mordecai gave her sound advice. Was that the hand? Oh, yes.
I came across something. It was like a historical novel about Esther, and so of course there's a lot of added stuff. And the back of the book, it was claiming that this author did a lot of research and, you know, tried to make it as accurate and as possible. And she included in there some, which obviously must be something that wasn't factual, because he doesn't ever say it here. But her view take of it was also that Mordecai, that he was actually a fiancé of Esther, and that it was intended that he would actually end up marrying her. A possibility, or?
I don't know if that's a possibility or not. I've never heard that. That's all I can say. Yeah, I never, I did a lot of reading. That never came up. That's all I can say. Well, it's conjecture, no doubt. Is it impossible? Probably isn't impossible. I don't know where you'd get it from, yeah. Well, yeah, especially in the light, I mean, it obviously would go against our traditional way of thinking, which is a Judeo-Christian ethic. I mean, raised her as his daughter. You don't raise your daughter to marry her, you know. It doesn't seem to fit well. Yeah. Well, it was fiction, you said, right?
Yeah.
Historical fiction.
Yeah.
They take license, so I'm not sure. So, but thank you. Thank you for bringing that up. Anything else? Anybody would like to ask or say? Okay, now, we see the situation going the way that it is. Mordecai gives her sound advice. Remember, the Jewish people were not respected in the Persian Empire. In fact, but if we get to the end, near the end of the book, we're going to see that Haman is able to make a law and a decree that all the Jews could be killed on a certain day. An extermination. A legal extermination. Now, the king doesn't know that his wife is Jewish. You know, that much we do know, because she's never allowed to tell him. Mordecai says, don't tell him who you are. Don't tell him of your family background. And that's important. And the Jews were often considered just, we have to realize, well, okay, let me put it this way. Think of the way that the Middle Easterners think of the Jews today. Okay. Not a lot has changed, you know, throughout history. The Jews were strange. They believed in one God. They had circumcision, which they considered very barbaric, you know. So all the heathen just said, what's the matter with these people? I mean, the heathens could all fellowship around the gods. This is our God. That's your God. We respect that. The Jews are saying, there's only one God. And they go, you know, that means that we are wrong. That means that our God isn't right, you know. So you can see the problem that they would have throughout history. And they have had problems just that way throughout history. So Mordecai wisely tells her, don't tell anybody who you are. Don't give away your family background. But Mordecai is in Shushan now, probably moved there to be with her, and has access, either through other servants or maybe even some direct access. It's hard to say, but probably through maidens going back and forth. As Esther has seven maidens, you might have noticed, she could easily send one out, go talk to that guy, and he'd send messages back to her that way. Well, verses 17 and 18, we're almost done here today. Let me find it here. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. Interesting note, you say, well, you know, in secular history, we really aren't finding Esther. So the skeptics say, obviously, this is a Jewish myth. It's a fable, it's a story, it doesn't really exist. You'll hear that if you go to a secular college and they talk about Queen Esther. We do need to understand something here. The story of Esther is very significant to us. It's a great story of God's providence, a great story of victory. In the grand scheme of the Persian Empire, the story of Esther is relatively insignificant, especially since Artaxerxes will have other wives after her. You know, and she's just almost an afterthought, maybe even an embarrassment that comes on later, that our king would get duped to marry a Jewish girl, you know. So, well, it could be that she's just wiped out of the history books, basically. She really has no significance to the Persians themselves as they write their own histories. And, like I said, it may even be a little bit of an embarrassment. But we have the recorded history here. There really is absolutely no reason to doubt it at all There's nothing from secular history that contradicts the Book of Esther. And so the, a lot of times the skeptics are skeptics because they want to be skeptics. They're unbelievers because they want to be unbelievers. That's what they want. That's what they are, and that's what they want to be. And often God in his providence allows them to be very much embarrassed later on as new historical things come to light. And that's exactly what happened with the Hittites, where 100 years ago they would have mocked you for believing there ever was such a civilization as the Hittites that the Bible talks about. Nothing's ever been found about this civilization. They don't even exist. The Bible just made them up out of thin air. They're imaginary villains of the Israelites. And now the Hittite civilization has been well documented, well discovered. It was a huge flourishing civilization. You go to college classes today, they won't tell you about the Hittites being a myth. They'll tell you all about the Hittite civilization and how it existed. But they won't tell you that 100 years ago, we didn't believe they existed and the Bible was right all along. They won't tell you that, you know, unless you have a Christian teacher and he sneaks it in there. So anyway, the next thing that happens, so she's set up as the queen, but the next thing that happens is very significant, and this is where we'll end. This is important for the book, too, as this book is just intertwined and interrelated all the way through. We go down to verse 19. When the virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. By sitting within the king's gate means that he probably had a position of authority of some kind, probably not great authority, but no doubt at the command of Esther, he was given maybe a small judgeship. Sitting at the gate is a role of honor. So she had got her uncle close to her, is what she had done. He stood at the king's gate. Now Esther had not yet revealed her kindred and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. And there is a moral lesson that can be learned there, I think. Obviously, things went well for her because she was obedient to her authorities over her. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs came and became furious and sought to lay hands on King Xerxes. So the matter became known to Mordecai. He was in that position where he could hear about this plot. And he told Queen Esther. And Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. She basically says, the guy out there that we made judge, he just uncovered a conspiracy and uncovered a plot against you. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed. And both were hanged on a gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Interestingly enough, though, quickly forgotten, but will be remembered again when we get to chapter 6. Because the guy has a sleepless night and says, well, how do you want to go to sleep? Well, why don't you read me my history as king? That'll put me to sleep, you know. And sure enough, they find out, hey, this guy named Mordecai uncovered a plot. We checked it out, and it was true. And the king said, what did we do for Mordecai to honor him? Well, I guess we didn't ever do anything. Things just kept on going. And that becomes an extremely important part of God's providence in this entire story of intertwined. Anything in closing here? We're basically done. If you have a question, now is a good time to ask it. You know, yes, Linda.
You were talking about like the doubts about this actually happening and everything like that. But the Jews still celebrate the holiday that came out of this. So that seems like it would be giving some historical.
It does. I agree with you. It does. I mean, the Jews still celebrate Purim. Purim comes from this whole thing. Well, no, I don't think they do either. But you got to remember that unbelieving scholars just say, well, they had to come up with a myth story to justify their holiday. And they say there's always unbelief has as many. John Watson used to put it this way. Still does, I'm sure. I haven't heard him say it in a long time, but he says there's one truth and 1,000 lies. So lies take many forms, you know, but there actually is one truth that works its way on through. And men are often, of course, coming up with lies to explain away the truth because they don't want to believe. They look at things backwards.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't this after King Cyrus decreed that they could go back to their land?
This is after that.
They decided to stay instead of go there.
Yeah, because not everybody went back. For some reason, and we don't know why, Mordecai and Esther didn't go back. But do remember that the vast majority of Jews didn't go back. It's actually a very small group. And they went back in different groupings, too. Under Cyrus, what the first wave, what was it? I'm off the top of my head, 50,000, I think, went back the first time. That's not very many. And then there was a second wave of immigration. Then there was a third wave under Nehemiah. And still, you didn't have a tremendous... More Jews lived outside of the land of Palestine at that time than lived inside. And I'm not sure that ever changed.
It's more comfortable for them to stay here then.
Yeah.
And reestablish their home.
Probably so, yeah. There may be a host of reasons. Now, in some ways, we can see God's providential hand here. For whatever reason, Mordecai and Esther didn't go back. We could certainly say it's the providence of God because he had other purposes for them. That's another hint. Yes, Brendan.
I think it's the response to those who challenge the authority of the Old Testament. They say that it's a miracle. So you may think of Jesus with the disciples on the road to Emmaus. He was founded from the law, the prophets, and the Psalms. So he offered them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the book of Esther was a recognized part of the Jewish canon at that time in history, by the way. You know, like I said earlier, we find more commentaries on the book of Esther than we do anything except the Pentateuch itself amongst the Jewish writers. Purim itself is an interesting feast, and one thing, just by way of note, we've talked about Purim. Most of the Jewish feast days have to do with repentance of sin, and fasting and sorrow. What we have here is the one that has to do with rejoicing and joy and feasting and celebration. And just look up Purim on a search and learn a bit more about that holiday, and you'll see it's a joyous holiday. Anything else here? Okay, thank you for your kind attention. If you would like, read the next couple of chapters of the book of Esther.